Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security practitioners who will introduce themselves. And notice how I said practitioners and not experts, because there was an article floating around the internet earlier this week, and it says that if you call yourself an expert, you have this mindset that you're done learning. And since we're in the field of security, there's always more to learn, similar to how doctors practice medicine and how attorneys practice law. So guys, introduce yourselves and tell us what you're learning to improve your knowledge base.
This is Mike, and I think I'm continuing to learn a lot more about the Microsoft tools ecosystem. My background is a lot more Linux, Unix. I think I still have prejudices is the right word, but preferences for those systems, but continually learning more and more about the Microsoft ecosystem.
Hi, this is Killian. And actually, being on this show really helps me continue to learn what's out there. It forces me to go out and seek out additional information for articles to talk about on the show. And once I do that, or once I start kind of going down that rabbit hole, it encourages me to keep learning additional things, or even Mike's tools every week. That's something that I might not be exposed to. And it's a great opportunity to see from Mike's perspective what's out there. And I also go out of my way to volunteer to go to trade shows and customer events as part of my job, because it's great to see how the field and what's out there is evolving. And also interact with customers to hear what their concerns are, what they're seeing on a day-to-day basis, which I might not be exposed to.
Yeah, this is Chris Kaiser. I'll agree with Killian. Being on this show is incredibly helpful. He does a lot of more of the research in terms of finding these articles than I do. But you know, every time that I appear on this show, I definitely do a bit of prep work ahead of time reading these articles and learning a whole bunch about it. On top of that, I just try and read as much as I can online. I also talk to my, I don't know if you guys know, I had a twin brother, but he works over at AT&T, and he works in malware analysis, and he tells me a whole bunch of stuff. The stuff that he's allowed to say is fascinating. He's definitely keep me up to speed on how things are developing in this field. So it's good to have good context that can keep you up to date as well.
Now, Chris, which one of you two is the evil twin? I mean, you have a beard mustache, so.
No, that's a good question. Now, we used to gauge it by the beard and mustache. We kind of switch back on and off who has the mustache, who has the beard, who doesn't. I think it must fluctuate back and forth, you know?
It's like the sisterhood of the traveling pants, except with facial hair.
So. Right. You know, and then
wait,
you know, wake up.
Does it mean that I need to start growing a beard?
Honestly, I think the rest of us have enough already. If anything, I think we should start shaving more.
I don't know. Maybe we can get you a fake beard or something to wear during the show, just so you feel like part of the group.
Maybe. We'll try that. In November, it's like mustache month or something like that.
Yeah. We're Movember.
So. Oh, okay. Okay, well, before we begin, I have a housekeeping announcement. If you're a regular listener and enjoy our show, please go to iTunes to rate and review the Inside Out Security Show, and we'll put you in the running for a deck of our InfoSec cards that's based on the Cards Against Humanity card game. And to learn more, please visit Varonis.com/review. And on to today's show. Let's go back to talking about experts versus practitioners for a bit. Before I joined the InfoSec world, it's probably something that my dad taught me, that if you can do something perfectly and do it even better and work towards it, you should, because you can. And so for the longest time, I held on to the idea that you have to try to make security perfect. And I also, it's not just me. I hear from others that aren't in the InfoSec space, you know, why can't security people just get it right? I'm tired of having to figure out all my settings and read all the time. We've been able to create all this great technology. Why can't we get security right? And Mike, you said last week that security isn't binary. It's about being more secure or less secure. And so do you think by switching the name to security practitioners that it'll help people think of security more as a gradient rather than a binary thing?
I sort of despair at trying to get non-technical people to think about security at all most of the time. That there's new technology, they expect it to just work and be very easy. And even that is such a challenge most of the time that security is the last thing they think about, like literally, that they just want it to work and like, great, this is shared. And they just don't have the context to think about potential downsides.
I like to think about it as an illness, too. I remember our CEO, Yaki, said one time that, you know, people are going to get sick and then go to the doctors. And so they don't think about being sick all the time.
I didn't want to, you know, spill the beans, but, you know, since it's just between us and our listeners here, we can actually get security perfect. We do this on purpose because we all need to, you know, keep paying our rent and, you know, and Mike needs to build another garage for his Tesla. So we do it on purpose. I just, you know, just between the all of us.
You know, I like the medicine analogy for this. I really do. It's kind of the thought that you can, you know, cure one illness, you can cure one piece, but there's always going to be something else that comes up. You know, you could be, I don't know, get the flu 1 week and then you know, have some other illness the other week. You fix the first problem, another one pops up. I think it's comparable to that in that, you know, there's always going to be new issues. As we're saying, this is constantly evolving. We get it as close as we can to write for the scenario that we're in at the time and then for the next thing to pop up and handle it.
Actually, on kind of a serious note, based on what Chris said and then the healthcare analogy, I think there's even more layers to it. Typically, what we talk about in terms of security threats is just treating the symptom. When you go to the doctor, you have some symptom that you want addressed. And a lot of times, I want my nose to stop running, something like that. But it doesn't treat necessarily the root of the problem. And I feel like in security, a lot of times we kind of have that mindset. Here's this, you know, the symptom that we need to deal with. And it's a lot of plugging holes, but we don't kind of go back and say, well, wait, why is this, you know, or is there something below this symptom that's actually causing the problem? So it's a little bit of a mindset. And this is kind of to Mike's point too, is we want things to be easy for people to be able to use. And plugging holes, security holes, in some senses is the easier thing to do. I'm going to get this point thing to solve this one problem, as opposed to thinking kind of security in depth or thinking deeper. Hey, if I change the way we manage passwords or the password policy, maybe we'd avoid some of the symptoms down the line that we have to deal with.
I was just going to say that I think a lot of this is almost more IT related than security related. There's a joke that is always around IT that, like, hey, nothing's working. What are we paying IT for? And then, you know, the next week is, hey, everything is working and it's just going fine. Why do we even need IT? I think it's that same sort of situation with security where, you know, like we've talked to customers, like we don't talk a lot about our own products on here, but, you know, we have had situations where talk to a customer like, oh, we don't have any problems with ransomware. We have this great system where it just takes an hour. And as soon as there's a ransomware outbreak, we can sort of quarantine it, block it off, get in touch, figure out which files are there that were compromised, and then restore them from backup if they're available on backup. And if not, you know, the user only loses a couple days worth of data. And that's acceptable to them in some way. It's not ideal. And there's a cost to that that constantly happens as they, you know, do that every single week and they never deal with the root of the problem.
Another attempt to shift our perspective is that it seems that customers, they're now beginning to understand the price they pay for free service. For instance, users were alarmed when the inbox cleanup service EnrollMe actually sells user data. So they learned about this when Uber bought their EnrollMe's data to gauge how well they were doing. And it's a business measurement for them.
I think this is a really good segue from the last topic. And, you know, you had started off talking about, like, why can't technology just work? Why can't things just be secure? In the case of EnrollMe and Uber and Lyft, it's something that has to do with the definition of what this data is. I suggested this EnrollMe article because I think it gets into a lot of the perceptions of what people think of as their data and what's secure and what's not and how it's used. And so there's been a huge outcry this week that EnrollMe sold your emails to Uber and that this was a horrible thing, that this was something that they weren't told about, that they didn't realize that EnrollMe worked this way. And so this was an interesting thing to me in that this goes to a lot of what Cindy was saying, which is like, why can't technology just work? And in part, I think it's because we have different definitions and tolerances for how this stuff is on the back end. So what Unroll.me was selling wasn't so much your email. Like, no one forwarded your Gmail from your inbox to, you know, Travis Kalanichek, the CEO of Uber. And no one at Uber, to my knowledge, at least from what's been reported, has actually like seen these emails of people. What they've gotten is a PowerPoint slide. And what that PowerPoint slide said was, well, in New York, for the month of January, for all the Unroll.me users who are in New York, Lyft receipts were down 5%. Then in February, they were up 10%. And then in that, it's this anonymized data. And beyond anonymized, as far as I can tell, it's been aggregated. That it really is like what's been shared has been a data point on a PowerPoint slide. It hasn't been the raw data of all this stuff. And that's something very different than what we normally talk about. So most people are talking about this almost like it's a data breach that, hey, Uber got like all of my emails and they're like digging through them to find secrets. And that's not the case. Part of my pushback here is not that I'm saying, oh, this is delightful and everyone should be okay with this, so much as I think it's useful to really delineate what happened and to make a distinction from other situations where something has happened like this.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump in here mainly because I was excited to talk about this one because I do use this service. I had no idea about this, and I do think that you're completely right. This was sort of presented to a lot of people as, you know, my individual email with my name and, you know, the date and time that I took a Lyft cab was sent out. You know, clearly it's not that. It's far more vague than that. You know, you're not getting those kind of details. It's interesting to see it presented that way because with the initial, you know, response people have is kind of a panic or like a disgust kind of response. But after you realize how little is actually being sent or how anonymous this data actually is, I still use it. I still use Unroll.me. I don't think I've been turned off enough by that. I have other services that I use that they know way more about me than Uber does. So it's a matter of, you know, how bad is this to you? How much does it matter to you? I do think that this is sort of a perfect storm with the fact that Uber's been getting a ton of horrible press lately. If it was some other company, I'm not sure the backlash would be nearly as much.
If I completely understand that if you're a service and you need to make money somehow, of course you're going to sell your data. Of course you're going to have to sell every search that I've made on Google or Yahoo or wherever in order to make money. I think that it would be naive to think otherwise.
My big takeaway from this is more of a PR issue than it is a technical issue. But the way that it's been handled from the company perspective, I just don't think I would do any better on it. But I think consumers don't realize, or maybe it's not communicated clearly enough, how companies make money. And the Unroll.me kind of response to that, I thought it could have used a softer touch, I guess. They're like, oh, we're sorry that you don't realize that we do this. I feel like there was a better way you could have probably said that, but it didn't help their case.
An interesting aspect of this to me, like Cindy, you were sort of bringing up that, and there's a phrase that I think gets tossed around maybe almost too much, which is that if you're not paying for it, you're what's being sold. And Unroll.me has always been this free service that has tried to make money on the back end. They have for years said like, oh, well, we sell reports. We sell aggregated data stuff. It was not a surprise to me that this was happening. And maybe this is just that people hate Uber that much that anything with them is tainted. But so you have Unroll.me who is selling this aggregated data of your emails. Again, like a dot on a PowerPoint slide. And people are flipping out about this. And at the same time, they're using Gmail, where Gmail is like going through every single one of your emails algorithmically and saying like, oh, it seems like you have a pet. Maybe you want to buy this high brand pet food. Oh, it seems like you have a kid. Maybe you want to get this other newsletter that sells, you know, kid catalog stuff. That's so weird that people are like, oh, my privacy is so violated because this third-party access, which I explicitly gave them access to, by the nature of the service, they would have to like take every one of my emails and look at it and see what to do with it. And it's bad when Unroll.me does it, and it's great when Gmail does it. I just haven't seen any sort of logical reconciliation of that concept between the two services and how they work.
Let's move on to other stories. It's going to require an even bigger shift in perspective when it comes to looking at old and new technologies, and depending on the attack or vulnerability, that security will appear to have been stronger or weaker. Let's start with the antivirus story that Killian found. What happened is that software mislabeled Windows as dangerous, and it stalled thousands of people who used this service. Some went on Twitter and joked about how they installed some ransomware, sort of like a joke, but really thousands of people's machines went down. What went wrong here, Killian?
So I don't know. Maybe I'll leave the easy jokes up to Mike, since he's more of a Linux Unix guy about, you know, labeling Windows as malware. But anyway, this struck home a little bit for me too, because in previous lives, I've actually run into a situation where something very similar happened, and it did cause quite a pain being on the restoration end, trying to get all these machines back up when it happens. But basically, there was a problem with the definition updates or something like that, and the antivirus software misidentified critical Windows system files as being malicious, and they took corrective action on it. And as a result of that, it bricked a bunch of machines. So this kind of is the double-edged sword of security. We rely on it to keep us safe, to block the bad things, but we have to realize security in all forms is not perfect, and we do run this risk. Some of the more well-baked technologies, like antivirus, typically don't have so many of these problems, but I'll draw a parallel to some other security things in the industry. When IDS systems and IPS systems reigned supreme in, you know, in the 90s and 2000s, everybody wanted these next-gen intrusion prevention systems. They wanted to automate the, you know, stopping these types of attacks in progress. And some of the major vendors ran TV commercials and things like that, like, oh, fully automated security defense. It learns all this stuff and then takes action. But in practice, or at least in my experience, almost nobody actually turned on the prevention feature for fear of wiping somebody out or preventing a VIP from performing their operation. So it's a very fine balance, automating security defense versus having humans still in the loop. So this is one of those situations where bad things can happen, but, and some of these folks have paid the price for it, but overall, I think we're still better with the security solutions in place. And it just goes to show that we still need to do our diligence, and we still need to have backup plans, even when we, you know, think that our security is bulletproof in a way.
This is sort of the thing that, working in IT and running into, you know, all kinds of malware and stuff pretending to look like Windows binaries, I was like, when is it going to happen? You know, they always try and fake out the different products that are trying to catch them by pretending to be these Windows binaries and Windows files that are legitimate. And I'm like, you know, sometimes we find them, sometimes we don't, but one day it's going to flip it around. And it seems to have finally happened.
The next article I found on Brian Krebs's website, when he talked about an experience in just buying something on Amazon because he wanted these super expensive speakers that were sold relatively cheaply. And what happened is that third-party seller accounts got hijacked. And so what had happened is one night everything, their account, their seller's shop was fine. And then the next morning, their seller's account and their email wasn't associated with the seller at all. They couldn't access their account for a week, and their account started having fake electronic products on their storefront. What's been happening a lot lately is that the bad guys, they're selling hacked Amazon accounts for as cheap as $2.50. He equated it as buying like a coffee at Starbucks. And so I guess what I really liked about this piece is that Amazon, it was a new and upcoming retail shopping experience, and then people are exploiting opportunities to make money off of it. And so it reminds me of what Mike always says. Well, who should you blame? Should you blame the bad guys? Should you blame Amazon for having security measures that aren't secure enough? What are your thoughts on this complicated web of how we do business, how other people attempt to take advantage of certain opportunities?
I was really struck by how sophisticated this was, where it's not a situation of someone just, I guess, using a stolen credit card to try to buy something. this is really sophisticated in that taking over accounts and then essentially marketing them and trying to do it in such a way that really slipped through a lot of the safeguards that are already in place. Like they were advertising a new model of this speaker for 32% off, but it wasn't they were selling it for 90% off, which might have raised some red flags. And it wasn't that they were just like giving them away, but that they had them. And then they made a fake tracking number and they were just trying to sort of maximize their chances at all of this, which tells me that they're doing this a lot. This is not their first time running the scam. And that it sounds like even that it's in two parts, that they're taking over the seller accounts and then they're buying the Amazon consumer accounts and probably running those through the same way to try to just extract as much as possible from these. Like a lot of stuff, I am not sure entirely how you would stop it. One of the things that came to mind was actually from a lot of the online gaming services. They have restrictions on account changes, that once an account change is made, that it locks the account for a certain period of time so no more changes can be made, that there's multiple levels of, you know, re-authenticating and changing stuff like the primary login. And, you know, we talked about like two-factor and things like that. I think some of that might have actually helped here.
On a positive side of this, Amazon's actually incredibly good about supporting their customers in terms of refunding the money. And it's funny that this story came up and it's as big of an issue now and people are really starting to catch on. This actually happened to a friend of mine maybe like a month or two ago. I think the Nintendo Switches are still almost impossible to get a hold of. And
yeah.
He was looking for one on Amazon and he's like, I found this seller that had it. They just came into stock. It was a little bit cheaper than normal because people were selling them at crazy inflated prices. But he's like, I'll throw my money in on it. And it turned out to be one of these scams. The same thing with the, it said it shipped and everything else. And then, you know, after a couple days, I think Amazon caught wise to it, probably from some other reports, because he's like, oh, I got an email from Amazon saying they refunded my money. But there's another layer of sophistication too, that the people doing this are looking at trends in what's in demand right now. So the speakers, the Nintendo Switch, things that people are really after to take advantage to try and, you know, maximize their potential for people to buy into their scam. So it's a little bit of, I don't know, social engineering is maybe not the right phrase for it, but market research maybe to make sure their scams are as effective as possible.
So I really like this BreakerBot story that Mike found. They're super bad guys where they scan the internet for IoT devices that use default passwords, and then they end up wiping the device and end up corrupting it completely. That's pretty powerful stuff there.
The reason I thought this was interesting was it sort of approaches this in a different way. So it's called BreakerBot, and because it bricks your Internet of Things devices that are open on the internet. So there's been lots of stuff like distributed denial of service attacks and people not realizing that, you know, all of their baby monitoring stuff is actually being broadcasted plain to the internet. Lots of things like that. And so what this does is just goes through and destroys all those devices by like pushing a bad firmware update to it or something. And so then it's worthless. And how they characterize this is sort of like internet chemotherapy, that it makes the internet, like it's destroying these devices for the express purpose of inoculating the rest of the internet from the bad capabilities of this. That once the remote garage door camera is destroyed, it's not going to be launching any distributed denial of service attacks. It's not going to be part of that. It's not going to be possible for it to be misused. And it's this very like harsh lesson that like, oh, you should worry about this stuff, that you're going to lose your expensive device if you don't actually secure it. And of course, this, you know, gets back to the manufacturers as well and stuff. So I thought it was kind of crazy for those reasons.
When I read the article, the first thing that popped into my mind is if anybody's familiar with the Death Wish movies with good old Charles Bronson from the 70s, just kind of the approach that guy took. He's basically being a technology vigilante in a way, you know, going out and doing something that I don't think anybody can argue is the right thing to do by destroying these. But there is an argument to be made, and I think it's a valid one, that is this for the greater good? We can get probably an entire episode about talking about the greater good, but in some ways, the guy who wrote this BreakerBot is, I don't know if we we could call him a hero like in the article, but I think it's at least it's worth thinking about and really considering. Now, being the victim of it and having your, you know, webcam or whatever destroyed really stinks. You know, you put your money down for it and now it doesn't work. But on the other hand, you're hopefully going to go back to the manufacturer and demand that they, you know, provide a product or whatever it happens to be that not only works and does what is advertised, but hopefully does it in a secure way. So it's kind of forcing their hand to take some of this stuff seriously, but in a very kind of heavy-handed approach.
I think the idea of, you know, causing innocent consumers damage to their devices because of a mistake a manufacturer made isn't exactly ethical. I did think in the article, the thing that stood out to me was the fact that there's obviously been other attempts at this before that are less malicious or less destructive. They mentioned two other methodologies that people had used before where they would infect Internet of Things devices to basically patch them and improve things. And I kind of feel like that's more of the approach that I wish was taken in this case, something that would go out and improve things instead of causing damage. I do wonder whether there's going to be, from the manufacturer's perspective, what their liability is going to be on this, if they suddenly have millions of people coming back with, I don't know which device it would be, you know, my garage door opener is destroyed now, you guys are responsible because you didn't patch this. Are they liable? Are they responsible? Are they legally, you know, required to replace it? I don't know how that actually would work.
There is, I think, some catharsis in it too. I'm sure, you know, there are some security practitioners out there reading this and going like, yeah, I had to recover. I had to help bring my business online after denial of service, and I'd like to give that webcam or whatever it was the boot right into the trash can. Again, two movie references for everybody out there today. I just think of this scene from Office Space where they take that printer out and smash it. There's some catharsis in taking some revenge in a way. Again, something that really does cause a lot of problems. It's not the right thing to do, but sometimes, you know, it can feel good, I guess.
It's not the thrust of this article, but it does say that this guy does try to patch them first, and if they can't be patched, but he doesn't really, they say they don't really say how. I'm sure it's different for every device, but if they can't be patched, then he destroys the device. And I imagine a lot of cases, this is actually not so much the device as it is like their network configuration, that they have things not locked down properly, so it's impossible to fix. Like, I don't think anyone's going back to the manufacturer and saying, hey, I got hit by this remote thing that destroyed my IoT device. They're like, oh, the stupid thing just stopped working. You know, I bought it for $50 and now it doesn't work. Can I get a new one? It's the same people that don't realize that their devices were being used in an attack because maybe the average consumer isn't doing deep packet inspection on their home networks, you know, for fun every week.
Before we go to Mike's tool of the week, and in the spirit of becoming, instead of know-it-alls, we're wanting to be learn-it-alls, I wanted to see what you guys learned from each other in this episode. I learned that despite setting up shops on Amazon so that you're sort of outsourcing your online web store and you don't have to worry about it, or having an IoT device, that we're all security practitioners. You know how they say that we're all our own brand. I think that as we try to make it easy for everyone to do things themselves, that we still continuously have to learn about security, and in order to keep ourselves, our data, and our devices safe.
I think one of the things that I learned, or maybe was reinforced, is that you always have to ask yourself the question, who is paying the bills for some of this stuff? You know, for the free services that we all love, like, you know, like Google, like, you know, if you like the Unroll Me, the money's coming from somewhere. And we always have to kind of be cognizant of that, you know, nothing really is free in life. And these companies are out to make money. So it's just be a little bit kind of cognizant of that when making decisions on what to sign up for.
I learned that, again, my expectations for how much trouble a cyber criminal will go through to pull off something was again set too low, and they far exceeded my expectations with this crazy Amazon setup. It's like if someone, you know, knocked out the guy at the local, you know, farmer's market and drug him in the back and then started selling fake fruit in the front for an hour to, you know, get more cash in the till. It's just, I was not thinking that would be an attack. It makes sense why it is, but I was just deeply disappointed in humanity when we talked about that.
This is Chris. I think that one of the things that was, again, more reinforced than learned is the importance of proper communication around stuff like this. The fact that, you know, you could easily have you know, a company's livelihood affected by a single article or something that might be blown out of proportion, like in the case with the Unroll Me incident. You know, I think if people truly understood exactly what was being communicated and what wasn't being communicated, what kind of data was being used or presented to Uber, I think it would have been far less of a damaging thing for Unroll Me, which, you know, as I said before, I don't think it's as big of a problem as it was made out to be. And that kind of stuff can get out of hand pretty quickly and can cause some damage. So I think communication is key, and getting the point across properly is important.
Thanks, guys. I really like actually listening to what you guys learned because it reinforces what I just learned too, because there are so many different points. So, Mike, what's the tool this week?
The tool this week is Lockout Status. So this is a Microsoft utility that you can use both from, you know, command line. You could script this with PowerShell, but it has a little GUI. And a very common scenario is that you're a sysadmin. You have 1,000 users, and every day one of your users is getting locked out, that they have too many bad password attempts, their account gets locked out. You're like, why on earth is this happening? And you go and unlock them. The next day they get locked out again. And so this is a bad scenario. Like, you don't know, was this person's account credentials compromised? Is this someone from outside trying to get in? Is this some weird utility that's running on their system that's trying to make an unauthorized access to something and getting locked out? So this tool lets you diagnose where and what devices the lockouts are coming from and to really track that down. And it's a very difficult and tedious thing if you're not using one of these tools. So Lockout Status from Microsoft.
Thanks to Mike Buckby, Killian Engler, Chris Kaiser, and all our listeners for joining us today.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.